Welcome to Driven Minds. I'm Gigi, and this is a Type 7 podcast. Before we jump into today's show, I just want to thank everyone so much for the time they take listening to this podcast. And if you haven't subscribed yet, please hit that subscribe button. And if you feel so inclined, give us a rating. Let us know your thoughts, feedback, concerns. We want to hear it all. So drop that in the comments section. Our guest today is Rupi Kaur. Rupi is a poet who initially rose to prominence when she started posting her simple, evocative prose on Instagram. She gained wider recognition when she published her first poetry collection in 2014 called Milk and Honey. The book has sold 2.5 million copies, spent 77 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and has been translated into 25 languages. She's since published two more collections titled The Sun and Her Flowers and Homebody. Rupi also tours around the world, performing her poetry to sold-out auditoriums. So here it is, my conversation with Rupi Kaur. Before we jump in here, I want to make sure that I've been saying your last name correctly in my head.
It's Kaur, like apple core.
And you chose your last name, right?
I have another last name. Every Sikh woman has a last name Kaur. Uh-huh. And when we moved to Canada, some families keep it as a last name. My parents put it as my middle name and added our caste name as a last name. But we also are not meant to believe in caste and continue to uphold that system. And so when I was going to publish my book, I didn't want to use that name. Mm-hmm. And this one just felt like much more, it is much more inclusive, and it's the name that all Sikh women have. So I was like, oh my God, it would be so dope for like a 10-year-old Sikh girl to walk into a bookstore in Toronto and see her name on the shelf.
And you're originally born in Punjab in 1992.
Yes.
And you immigrated to Canada when you were how old?
When I was 3.5.
Do you have any childhood memories that have actually stayed with you from that time?
The correct answer is I don't know, because I feel like a lot of the memories we think we have are just the stories we've been told by, you know, our family members over and over and over again. And some of those stories are, I think I remember the flight over and hating it. I mean, we're from a very rural village, you know, no plastic. And so on the flight, I saw a plastic water bottle for the first time. And I was so intrigued by it. And I was crying and crying because I wanted Punjabi snacks, but the flight didn't have any. And so the air hostesses were just coming around and giving me plastic water bottles to play with because I was so fascinated by them. And the other memory would be saying bye to my grandfather, which was my mom's dad. And my dad is a refugee, and he wasn't there when I was born. He had to leave the country before then. And so my grandfather was really like my dad for those first 3.5 years of my life. And when they were dropping me off, well, the whole family came, drove from Punjab to Delhi, which is like about 8 or 10 hours. And they were at the gate, and he's like handing me over to my mom for the last time. And I was crying, and they were like, oh no, no, we're gonna be right back. Like, it's no big deal. And apparently it was very difficult for them to like rip me apart from him. And so there's memories like that, going to the doctor for the first time in Montreal when we got here, feeling very foreign to go from a country which was very hot, very bright, very colorful, to landing in Montreal in the middle of one of the worst snowstorms, when everything was like icicles. It was very jarring, I think, especially for my mom.
That memory of you being taken from your grandfather and put on the airplane, that is probably actually a real memory, because I was talking to my therapist, and she was saying that the majority of the childhood memories that we retain as vividly as we do are usually traumatic. So even hearing you recall yours, I mean, they seem to be
not the best.
Yeah, you know, like that's intense, like leaving your hometown for the first time. I remember as well when I had to leave Santa Monica and move to New York when I was like 4.5. And I remember looking out the station wagon window, watching my house get smaller and smaller. So it's kind of my equivalent. Obviously, world's different, literally.
That's actually so true, because we've moved so much. And I do remember every single time driving off, leaving home behind and heading off to the next place with like a ball of anxiety in my stomach. And I also was like chatting with my therapist about bad memories in general. And what made me feel less bad about remembering so many is our brains like to remember the bad moments to protect us from, you know, them happening again. But it kind of sucks that you're like, I wish I could remember some of the happy ones. Yeah. But the brain just like lets them go.
And also it's like when we get older, I relocated from New York to Berlin and that was a choice and it was supposed to be a happy thing. And I'm sure my body is like, don't do it. Stay with what you know.
Yes.
And your parents retained a lot of their Punjabi culture when you came to Canada, right? Mm-hmm. How did that manifest for you growing up?
As an adult, I'm so thankful for it. If things were okay back home, they would have never left. And I think like that's the first thing, you know, when they arrived here and they weren't able to pick up English or get better jobs, they were constantly told, well, why are you complaining? You could just go back. But we didn't leave, at least because we wanted to. We left because my dad, it was a way for him to preserve his life.
What do you mean by preserve his life?
In 1984, there was a genocide that happened against the Sikh community perpetrated by the Indian government. So throughout the 80s and the 90s, the Punjab police was told to essentially disappear any Sikh man or boy. We don't even know the exact numbers because a lot of these people were picked up, disappeared, and their bodies were burnt and never documented. Boys as young as 10, 12 years old to people older than my dad at the time. And my dad was in his like early, late 20s. My dad was also picked up and he was imprisoned. And his older brother knew somebody who knew somebody. So he was able to free him. But when he came home back to the village after they freed him for the first time, his mom was like, you need to get out of here.
Right.
Because you're lucky enough to get out the first time, but if they come back for you, we can't help you. And he left, he arrived eventually after a very long journey, arrived in Montreal. And a lot of my community, Canada really opened up the doors for us. And so a lot of us settled in Canada, settled in Montreal and in the Toronto area. And a lot of my work really comes from that because they survived something that was so inhumane and vile. Mm-hmm. So we grew up going to protests and trying to raise awareness and bring justice to them. And so a lot of my uncles and my family friends, you know, they'll come over even today and they'll be like, oh yeah, this is like where I was hit by bullets when the army came, or this is where I was tortured, and this is what we had to eat when I was in prison for like 8 years, and how they treated us. And so this was just like everyday reality. So I think because of everything they lost, because we don't really have a land to call our own, and where our land is doesn't want us to survive, I think it was really important for my parents and overall the whole community to really preserve our Punjabi Sikh culture.
Yeah.
Because it was nowhere else. It's like you just had to hold it inside of you because it couldn't manifest in the physical world. And so it was really important for them to make sure that we spoke the language. And so we learned to read and write Punjabi, speak Punjabi. We learned to play our cultural music, all of that. And of course, you know, as a kid, you're like, this is so annoying. I just want to like go to ballet and learn piano. Yeah. But that is definitely not what we were learning. But, you know, as an adult, I'm so thankful because so much of my art comes from all the things that I'm able to like sort of dabble into when it comes to Punjabi and Sikh culture.
One thing that I was forced to do when I was younger is learn about Judaism because I'm Jewish and I hated every moment of it. I hated going to temple. I hated when I couldn't go out on Friday and had to go to synagogue. And it is so something that I appreciated only when I got older. And I'm so grateful for my dad for instilling that huge part of me and like, cultivating it when you're younger. But when you're younger, all you want to do is like blend the fuck in. And when we're older, all we want to do is stand out.
Absolutely. I was thinking when my mom would wear like her traditional Punjabi clothes, because we would go to the Gurdwara, which is our temple. So she would like, you know, wear our clothes and you'd go there. And like my worst nightmare is when we would be coming home and she'd be like, oh, let me just pop into the grocery store. And I'd be like, oh, like that. Too scared to ever say it out loud because I'd probably get told off, but it would be like so embarrassing. And now if she were to do that, I'd be like so proud of her.
Was there a divide between your home life and your school life?
For sure. I think like every immigrant or every kid with, you know, a culture that's very different to your typical American culture, I definitely felt that way because the parents, given their experiences. They didn't want us to assimilate to the point that we forgot about our heritage,
right,
and just became American. It would always felt like we were stuck between two worlds that never really crossed over. Mm-hmm. So depending on where you were in the situation, you learned to like put as much of it on.
And now you make a living as a highly esteemed and respected writer and poet, but you grew up with an insecurity when it came to speaking English, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I was the oldest of four, and because my parents never spoke English and we had no cousins, we lived in a very heavily populated immigrant community. So yes, I was living in Canada, but I didn't hear English for the first time until I like walked into kindergarten and I felt like I'd been abducted by aliens because
right.
it is so weird as a kid to be surrounded by noises and voices and you're like, what are you even saying? And so mm-hmm. I came to learn it very slowly, you know, not having anybody to practice with at home. So it was a slower process, but books really helped because I couldn't communicate and make friends. I really, really started falling in love with books in like second and third grade as soon as I could start to read a little bit. And that's all I did.
Kids make fun of anything they can.
Yeah.
So I can imagine they feasted on this insecurity of yours when it came to speaking English.
It's such a unique experience to grow up in a school where actually so many of us were immigrants, because I never really got bullied for the way that I spoke because everybody was a person of color, mostly from different parts of the world. More so like the way that I looked or people from my own community who maybe had more freedom than I did because their parents weren't as strict would then pick on the kids who they knew parents were strict and didn't allow them to do the things. And so I think it was more so internalized self-hate.
Right.
And then using that self-hate to make fun of others to make yourself feel like you fit in more.
I feel like that is a dynamic that is brought with us even as we age. I mean, just hearing you say that, I'm like, wait, I've experienced that 4 years ago,
yes.
you know?
Exactly.
But you found your voice because you self-published your first collection of poems when you were 21, titled Milk and Honey. How long were you working on the poems that went into this collection?
I had been writing poetry since middle school. Didn't really think much of it, even throughout high school, until I began to get involved with more community organizing and activism work. Up until that point, my activism was really based around the places that my dad took me. So all the protests he went to, the community events that he was involved in. But one day in high school, I saw a flyer for an open mic night run by a group of sick youth, maybe a decade older than me. And so I decided, why not go? And I wrote a little thing. I didn't even know that it was a spoken word poem at the time. But anyways, I wrote it and I was like, okay, let me go up there and perform it. And I have no idea what would possess me to do such a thing because it's so out of my character, my personality to stand in front of a group of people and be seen.
So you were super shy.
Like cringe level, like so, like I didn't speak. Even when I learned English, I was so silenced. It was hard for me to speak. I had like one friend in fifth grade and I would talk with her and like that was it. But mostly very silent, very observant. I don't know. I think that moment that I went to that open mic, something greater took over, was telling me to get up there. And so I went, I get up there and there was maybe about like 20, 25 people in the audience. And I said my piece. And I remember afterward being surrounded by all these people and they were all a decade older than me and they were so kind and they were so sweet and they were like, wow, you did so good. Like you have to come back. And it was the first time in my life that I felt supported, that I felt seen and I felt heard. And I loved it. And so I believed them when they said I was good, even though in hindsight, I know that poem sucked. And I continued to go back, started volunteering with the organization, went from volunteer to community organizer myself. And it was always issues back in the motherland and issues that affected the diaspora. And so that's where my love for myself started. You know, I went from being somebody who was very self-hating about her heritage. And this group taught me to love the fact that I was Punjabi, that I was Sikh, and also that I was a woman. Mm-hmm. So I started to perform, I started to write, and it was really being on stage that made me fall fall in love with the craft, and I was performing all the time. And so Milk and Honey was really the culmination of my years of learning to love myself, what that was like, and really coming up through my activism. And it was a happy accident. I loved books. I love reading, but not once did it cross my mind that I should ever write one. And it was really my readers on Tumblr who were like, oh, I love this poem of yours. Like, where do I get your book? And I was like, what are you talking about? And then they really planted that seed. And I was like, oh, maybe I should do that. And then I did.
And you self-published.
I did, yes. I took a creative writing class in university, and I remember talking to my professor. I was like, hey, so I'm like writing this book, and like, how do I get it published? Like, do you have any advice? And she was like, well, first of all, nobody really publishes poetry these days. Especially, you know, when you're so young and like poetry is kind of like a dying genre, you're better off submitting your poem. She gave me a list, these anthologies, these literary journals and magazines. And so I was like, okay, cool. I'll do that.
It's also a sad day when like a literature teacher tells you that poetry is dead and no one buys poetry books.
Exactly.
Did you have an idea that it would resonate with the people as deeply as it did?
I really didn't. And I love this like era of my life, that one, because I was never really worried about the outcome or result. I was so just living in the present moment, experiencing the joy of the journey and every moment. The hook for me was the feeling of connecting and sharing with others. That's why I do it. Mm-hmm. And the reason I self-published was really because I tried to submit to journals and I experienced rejection like all writers do. And so that didn't really bother me. But I realized that I read the poetry in the journals and it was not like my poetry. Mm. It wasn't about sexual assault. It wasn't about a young girl's experience with how to overcome that. It was about, you know, that list that my professor gave me. It was all about the Canadian landscape and this and that. And that's cool. But I realized, oh, my poetry doesn't fit in here. And also, that's not my audience, that type of reader that maybe just likes really traditional poetry. My audience was people like me, that 15-year-old girl coming from an immigrant family with not much financial security. Those were the people who were coming to my work on Tumblr, you know. And those are also readers that mostly go ignored by publishers because we're also seen as a group of people who might not read. And so I decided to self-publish just because I saw my book as like, I think if there's like 190 poems in there, let's just say there are. There's 190 individual poems, but the way that I've organized it, for me, it's one long continuous poem and journey. And I wanted to design it in a way that felt right to my heart and then sort of hand it off. And that's kind of how it happened.
What is so incredibly special about your writing, and it's immediately why it spoke to me, is that it captures these ostensibly private moments that so aptly describe my own experience that when I read them, it's literally like reading my thoughts, yet they're clearly universal thoughts if you're selling tens of millions of copies. Mm-hmm. Do you write for yourself and they just happen to land? Or do you like pull the people? Or what's the process?
It's the first one. I mean, I feel like I came into the world feeling too much.
Same, sister.
And so for me, writing a poem is like doing a puzzle.
Ooh, I like that.
I take all of it. And so my first draft is like messy. It's long and it's messy. Mm-hmm. And then the completing the puzzle part is like, okay, cool. I have this like hot mess.
Right.
What is like the core of this? What is really going on here?
Right.
It's like a peach pit. So that first draft is like a peach. And then what I want to do is get to the peach pit, the core of what I'm trying to say.
A lot of crossing out.
A lot of crossing out. You know, you're taking off the skin, off the fruit and all of that. And what is my thesis? And I want every single sentence and every single word to support that thesis. And so sometimes, you know, a poem might be saying too much and really not get to that core. And that's kind of like the editing process for me. So writing those short four liners is a lot more difficult than writing a poem that's like 5 or 7 minutes long.
Is your process retroactive or do you write about things as you experience them? Like, will you go through a breakup and be just pen to the page when you're in the fog, or do you tap into that pain after?
I do both, but it's more succinct when I tap into it after.
Really?
So I write all the time when it's like a season of writing. I mean, I don't write when I'm like on tour,
right. But
let's just say I go through a breakup. Yes, I will write. That would never end up in a book because it just sounds insane and nothing is like making much sense and it all very repetitive. Like, I feel like I'm dying. Ah, what's going on? And then, you know, over time, I feel like the poetry is written inside because over time that, I feel like I'm dying processes and more interesting legs and arms, you know, extend from that original thought. And then over time, it just like bakes better. And then when I reach for it, I feel like it comes out in a more poetic way.
I'm actually going through a breakup right now. I'm like 5 days in right now.
Oh,
so you're not catching me at my best moment right now.
I'm hugging you.
I feel it. But it's really funny that this breakup is coinciding with our conversation because, oh my God, I mean, all of your books, but especially Milk and Honey for me, just like reads like a breakup manual.
Fuck, it is.
It really does. And there's this one that like completely captured what I'm feeling.
I can't.
I'm so curious what you think I'm going to say because I'm sure you have all of that memorized in your thought palace. But I didn't leave because I stopped loving you. I left because the longer I stayed, the less I loved myself. When I read that, it was waterworks.
Oh.
What were you going through when you wrote that poem?
That one is written definitely long after, upon more reflection and realizing that exactly, like, I had to leave because the situation was making me hate myself. This person was making me hate myself,
totally.
You know, was extremely emotionally, physically abusive. There might be some poems in Milk and Honey, but especially a lot in The Sun and Her Flowers, chapter one, that came from the middle of the breakup. Sometimes I do go back to like my worst breakup moments and I read some shit and I'm like, oh my God, transported back to that moment.
Yeah.
That, you know, I thought everything was falling apart and it is very powerful. And I think that's what tens of millions of people connect with, because we might be so different. We might be divided by race, class, countries, borders, all of that. But the way we feel is universal.
When I read this poem, it was literally what I had said to him verbatim, which was essentially, I love you, but I respect myself too much to be disrespected by you on the regular. That's what I mean by these moments that I find are so unique to me, yet that's the power of your poems and also you speaking to these universal experiences of heartbreak that you feel so alone in when they happen. I mean, you're like, no one can possibly understand my pain.
I know.
You know?
Right? When we feel it, especially when it's a breakup.
What have been your most effective getting over breakup coping mechanisms?
I've always been creative. I love making things. And every single time I've had a breakup, I do something creative. I feel like it was really after breakups that I began to do things. So like I remember going through a breakup and just really leaning into my painting and my drawing because visual art was really my first love. And then going through another breakup and then just being like, I'm going to pour myself into performing. And even Milk and Honey, I had plans to publish that book. I thought that I was going to publish it in 2015. Then 2 months before it actually came out, I went through a horrible breakup. And then I just had to publish it. The next day, I was like, if I don't distract myself with something, I don't know how I'm going to live. Mm-hmm. And so I moved the timeline up by a year.
Yeah.
And then for 2 months, I was at, you know, sitting at the dinner table or on the living room carpet with my roommates around me, like feeding me like ramen noodles because I just like wouldn't get up. I'm just like losing my mind, organizing and drawing and all that. And that's really what helps me, being creative. And that's, in hindsight, being creative is when I feel closest to myself. It's when I feel the safest. It's when I can hear myself. I feel present. I'm so sorry you're going through that. My heart for you.
Oh, I appreciate it. And by the way, I know you're with me because I've read your whole book. So I know you're on my side here. In 2015, you also entered the public eye in a different way.
Oh, yeah.
you posted a photo of yourself in bed with a period stain on Instagram as part of a project you did for university. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I was doing, it was my visual rhetoric course, and this one was really based on design. And so we were asked to create a physical body of work that tackled a taboo, but we just weren't allowed to use any words. And I love photography. I've always dabbled in many mediums. And at that time, I was working a lot in photography. And I wanted to create a photo series around menstruation. And so for me, this was great because I was like, great, I get to do the thing that I've always wanted to do, never made time for. But then also, I get to get my like project out of the way. And so I have always had a complicated relationship with my period. I also just watched Hey God, the Judy Blume book. Now I'm going to mess up the title.
Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I swore by Judy Blume, and I carried that book everywhere with me.
Yes, me too. And I watched the film the other day, and it brought me back to being in the body of like my 10, 11-year-old self, the way I have not felt in decades. And so I had a complicated relationship with my period for many reasons. The first being that I came from a Punjabi family, and there was not a lot of, at least where my parents grew up, a lot of education around periods. It was something that was very secretive, very shameful. And so when I got my period, I was probably the last or the second last girl in class to get it. And I remember I was feeling excruciating pain. It was at school. And then I was feeling like so bad to the point that I felt like I was going to faint. I left French class. I go to the bathroom and then I just see and I start crying. And it felt like I was grieving something because it felt like in that moment my childhood was gone and I knew that nothing was going to be the same again. And I remember going to tell my mom after school and I felt so ashamed to tell her, you know, like I remember when we were supposed to do sex ed in fifth grade. We all had to get like a form signed by our parents. I was so afraid of getting it signed because the paper said the word sex on it. I thought my parents were going to yell at me. I forged the signature and handed it in.
Where do you think the stigma around sex came from? Was it directly from your parents? Was it reverberating in sick culture? Or
a little bit of both. I think a part of it was my experience with sexual assault. And I think another part of it was getting in trouble if the parents walked in and like somebody's kissing on screen and them screaming like, oh my God, turn it off, turn it
cover
off.
Cover your eyes. Yeah. My dad did that too. He would like take me to a PG-13 movie and the kissing scene, he'd be like covering my eyes. And I'm like, you are literally stigmatizing this and making me want to do this.
Yes.
You know, your sheer shame is making me want to do everything on screen.
Exactly.
You know?
They just don't know. So then they gave us like after sex ed, they gave us like pads and tampons. And I felt so ashamed. I hid them in my backpack. And when everybody went to sleep at like midnight, I snuck out of the house and I tossed them into my neighbor's garbage can. To me, for some reason, it felt like getting caught with condoms or some crazy thing in fifth grade.
Right, right.
I don't even know. And so when I got my period, my mom was in distress. She just was like, how could this happen?
That was her response?
It was her response because I think she felt so much shame. She's internalized misogyny and has to carry the weight of it. Mm-hmm. My dad doesn't have to. So my dad is really chill. So she has felt the shame of having three daughters in a culture where having a girl, it's a burden and it's not a good thing. You know, you get a boy, it's like, oh, that's the golden ticket. And so when I was born, my grandma called my dad and was like, oh, I'm so sorry. It's a girl. And she was crying on the phone. Wow. And my dad was like, if you're going to cry about this, like, don't call me again. And then when they moved over to Montreal.
Love your dad's vibe.
His vibe is great. And when my second sister was born, similar things. And I remember when my third sister was born. And when people came to visit, it felt like they were coming to the house to do condolences. It was kind of like, oh, congratulations, we're so sorry. And then my brother was born and it was like, oh my God, congratulations, finally. And it was like the greatest thing that happened.
That's traumatizing to witness.
For sure. And I think my parents have treated all of us the same and it's been nothing but love. But to watch the community or mother-in-law specifically put their daughter-in-laws through that abuse has been particularly interesting. Mm-hmm. So I had this like long history with like periods. And I remember my mom being like, you have your period, you can't jump on the trampoline. And me being in like eighth grade and being like, excuse me, why would you call me sick when I'm just experiencing something that half the people in this world experience? So I've always been a rebel. And for me, this project on periods was just to normalize this and really,
right,
as somebody who experiences so much pain during her period,
Sam,
stop hating it every time it comes around and embracing it. And I didn't think that it was going to be a big deal when I posted it online, because I've written about periods and I write about, I don't consider them taboo or controversial topics, but I write about such things. But I guess the visual representation of it was very alarming to not my core following. They loved it. So it was nothing but positive for the first few hours. But the moment it left my page and it started going on like the discovery page or the explore page, that's when it all sort of got really ugly.
What was this experience like for you? I heard your mom found out because you made local Punjabi radio.
It was everywhere, but I was like, how am I going to tell my mom?
Like, why? Why is this a big deal?
Yeah.
You're fully clothed in this image as well.
That was my dad's response.
Really?
My mom, on the other hand, she was scared. Like, you know, she was freaking out because she was like, oh. But the moment she realized my dad was chill, then she was chill.
Yeah.
She just like gets so dramatic. She thinks my dad's going to be so upset. And the moment she realizes he doesn't give a shit, she's like, yeah, I'm chill. I'm cool too.
Right.
So she came home. I was waiting. I'm like, okay, sweating. I'm like, how am I going to tell her? Because my relationship with my parents is like, you know, I feel like I protect them from a lot. We're not besties. I don't come home and I'm like, oh my God, my little crush in my class, like he's so cute. Or I just like went on this great date, mom. We don't have a relationship like that, you know? And so I was like, I have to tell them because somehow they're going to find out. And I feel like I'm going to get into trouble.
You're out of the house at this time, right? You're like 20 something.
I am like 20.
And you're still scared about getting into trouble.
Yeah. I have sold over 11 million books. I'm still scared about getting into trouble.
You know, it's funny that I am too. Sometimes I pick up and I'm like, am I in trouble? Like, what's going on? Yeah. Are you mad at me?
Yeah.
It's like residual from when I was perpetually grounded in middle and high school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm questioning you, but I am realizing I completely understand your fear.
And my parents are like, we don't really give a shit. Like, you'll always be like a child to us. And I'm like, that's fine.
Yeah.
But I was like, how am I going to tell my mom? How am I going to tell my mom? So I like, she comes home and I was visiting from, I had like the weekend off. So I came home to visit and, I'm like, so remember a few weeks ago when I was taking those photos that you didn't see because I told you, mom, get out of my room. And my sister was helping me photograph the photo series. My mom knew we were up to no good. I'm like, yeah, so people are really mad and this thing is, it's going viral. It's doing this. And she just was like, oh, so you're the girl they're talking about on the Punjabi radio. And the moment I realized there was like Punjabi uncles talking about this on Punjabi radio, I'm like, I gotta fucking call my dad because it's the worst if it comes from someone else. And then so I call him,
right.
I tell him, and he's like, ugh. He's like, why do people care about this? And I was like,
love him.
I don't know, babe. I don't know.
Was there a definitive before and after you posted this image in your life?
Yes. Everything changed when this image came out. My book was already out at this point.
Uh-huh.
So this was like 6 months in or something. And because of how viral it went, it was on the front page of Reddit, BuzzFeed. It was on every publication. And so
wild.
I experienced a level of anxiety that I had never felt before, because suddenly it felt like millions of people had access to me. And now I was seeing their opinions of me and what they wish they could do to my body, especially men, how they wish they could hurt me and other women or other people who stood by this image. And my anxiety has definitely lessened, but it was like after that, I was never really the same again.
So did you get full on death threats?
Yeah. I had more faith in the West, because I'm so naive, you know. I'm like, oh, education percentages are higher. Like, people will be more open to it. We're just, like, more liberal here than versus a place like India.
Right.
But no, I would say that the level of death and rape threats are all the same. And my Americanized experience had me perceiving my homeland in a certain type of way as a place that was maybe more misogynist. But I was getting emails from soldiers in the Middle East who were like, this is really powerful and I'm standing with you. And so, yeah, death threats, rape threats. I remember having to leave my house for the first time and my parents wouldn't let me go anywhere alone because they were just afraid what might happen if, when people see you out by yourself. And I started to get depressed at that point. And I think I didn't overcome that depression until, you know, very recently.
After all of this attention and your book picking up steam, you started touring around the world and you also published A Sun and Her Flowers in 2017, which was another hit. And you've been open about suffering from anxiety and depression during this time. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about this time?
I think being extremely burnt out, never really understanding what rest meant, what a vacation was.
When did you learn this?
Like, I took my family on our first ever family vacation in 2017. Mm. That was the first time my dad took a day off in his life. And we could afford to go somewhere.
He worked as a truck driver, right?
Yeah. And so majority of my life, he was gone, especially growing up, like 7 days a week. He would come home, sleep a little mm-hmm. bit. He would drive from Montreal to Texas to California. He was very sick for about a decade. He was extremely unwell, bedridden. And I remember I would have so much anxiety that at 10 years old thinking, so if he dies, how am I going to feed everyone? Because my mom doesn't work and she doesn't speak English. And I'm the oldest. And so I really got to figure my shit out because I have to make sure that we don't starve. Oddly enough, it got worse when I found success. I was able to give to them. And then the anxiety kicked up because it was like, it's going to all be taken away from me. And then what? Like, how do I secure this for our future? Mm. I think the success happened backwards. I think a lot of writers, you know, they work, and then later in their career, they experience success. And I feel like for me, it happened like totally backwards. It was like, I had no intention of doing any of this. I just love creating and sharing and connecting with my audiences. And boom, first book, it was self-published somehow. You know, it's the highest selling collection of poetry ever. It outsold Homer's The Odyssey.
I read that and loved it.
Thank you. So when I signed that second book deal and I went into writing the second one, it was the worst creative experience I've ever had.
Because of the pressure.
I was like, well, how am I going to do it again? You know, the moment you start to think, hey, I want to write a book that speaks to so many people, then I feel like you just can't do it. That's my belief, because then you just start to like overthink it and you're not really writing from an honest place. And so I remember locking myself up and my whole body was not working. I couldn't digest any food. I would have migraines that lasted 3 to 4 days. I was extremely depressed, extremely disassociating, but I had to meet a deadline. And I also think that the deadline wasn't realistic. That first book took me years to write, and then I signed this book contract, and I'm not pointing fingers at individuals or a company. I think it's the system.
Right.
It was suddenly like, do that again, but in like a few months.
How did you deal with your depression and anxiety during this time? And you mentioned that up until recently, you'd been carrying this anxiety. Mm-hmm. What has your journey been like?
I was in denial for a long time because I just couldn't understand why a time in my life where for the first time I was financially secure and physically safe, how could I be depressed? And I was working nonstop. It felt like I was on a high-speed train and like everything, my whole personal life was on hold. I accepted that I was depressed and needed help in the winter of 2018, when at this point I was having suicidal thoughts on a regular basis for years. I had a very blunt conversation with myself. I was visiting home, sitting at my parents' living room while they were away. And I just was like curled up into a ball. And I asked myself, you know, as I was having these suicidal thoughts, I was like, how long can I keep living like this? Like, if these thoughts never stopped, how long before I give in? And my brain said, 3 years tops, 4 if I'm lucky. And that scared me. Because I think when I realized that, I remembered that I actually want to be alive. And that's when I was like, whoa, I need to get help. And so I found a therapist. I tried meditation. I eventually tried medication, which for me, it was something that I was very much against, but has worked very well for me. Mm-hmm. I feel like I tried so many different things because I realized that there's no cure, there's treatment. And so I'm going to have to figure out what works for me. And I think a lot of my getting better happened also during the pandemic when I was forced to slow down. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would have never slowed down because I feel the pressure to take care of my team and my family. And when I had nowhere to go because of the pandemic, I felt stillness. And that's when my body began to sort of like come back to me. And I felt present and I felt there. And I wrote the final chapter of Homebody, which is probably like the more celebrative, more happy one.
What did your depression look like on a daily basis? Because I think there's an idea that has been mediatized of what depression looks like. Then there's actually the way that you experience it. And I hate the way that the media has glamorized and fashionized mental health, where it's like this heroin chic, super thin girl, like chain smoking cigarettes in like a messy bed in the middle of New York City. Yeah. And like, this is why people don't get help, because of these images.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious if you could weigh in.
For me, it felt like I was watching my life happen to me. It was like I was in a different place, in the sunken place. Everything was kind of fuzzy and blurry. It was happening to this body, but it wasn't happening to me. And, you know, you've run into people on the street or whatever, and they're like, oh, my God, how are you doing? Like, how do you feel now that you have all this, like, success? And the word that I used to describe all of it was weird. I feel weird. Mm. I feel weird because I didn't have the word yet to describe how horrible depression felt. And Homebody was really me challenging myself to like find the word. Because after a while, I'm like, I am so annoyed that I just keep using the word weird. It is much more than that. It was very physical. I could at some points not physically even feel myself. Mm. A lot of disassociation. Mm. I did well when I had strict schedules.
Oh, same.
Right?
Bless a schedule. Bless accountability. Saved my life.
So tour was great. I was like, I have to be on a flight every other day. I have to like sound check is at this time. I was the happiest when I'm on tour, and then I would get off, and then that's when I couldn't move for 2 weeks at a time. Mm. So I would say that is been the worst experience, but also one that's really equipped me with the ability to take care of myself from here on in. Like, I'm so conscious and so aware of how much I don't want to go back. And so I try to make decisions that are going to help preserve my mental health rather than like pull me back to that place.
It sounds like it was also valuable then in a way.
Yeah. I would still prefer if it never happened, but for example, I just finished like a year-long world tour, and I know that I need to take a few months off where I say no to everything, or I'm just going to be sucked into the whole system again and the hamster. When I like become the hamster, that's when the depression starts to come back, because it's not a human way to live.
One last question. What drives you?
I have to go back to wanting to connect and share with people. I don't know why it's important, but I've always felt the deep desire to connect and share with people. And maybe that's because when we connect and share with people, we feel less alone. I remember being a little girl, and when I would be walking outside and see someone who looked unhappy, I could feel their pain. And I would just think, oh my goodness, there's so much pain in the world. Like, I wish I could just take it all away. I think a way to take it all away is to reach out by connecting and sharing and having the opportunities to like look people in the eye and hear their stories. When I was on tour, I was really impacted by the fact that every single person in every single room I was in, the thought that kept coming to me was like, holy shit, there's like thousands of stories in this room. Mm. And each one is so important and profound.
There's this amazing Jonathan Safran Foer quote where he writes, and everything is illuminated, I can hear my bones crush under the weight of all the lives I'm not living.
Mm, that's beautiful.
People watching is the craziest experience for me, understanding that there are 500 people that just pass me in a single sitting that have their own problems, their own worries, their own families, their own heartbreaks, their own everything that I will never, ever be privy to. So I can't imagine this is amplified when you're on tour.
It's really humbling. It makes you feel closer to people. And that's really important and something I think we need in our world today as we experience so much polarization.
Totally.
You know, getting closer to people and realizing that most of us, all we just want to feel is love, is very helpful.
That, my friends, was Rupi Kaur. You can follow Rupi on Instagram at @RupiKaur_ and me at Gillian Sagansky. As always, I want to hear what you think of this episode or any past episodes. I also want to know who you want to hear from next. So shoot me a DM. Let's have a chat. And thanks for listening. Also, please don't forget to subscribe and give us a rating so we know you're out there alive and listening. Until next time.